comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Well, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, and it's the show, of course, where you matter. You know, folks, Dick Criswell is a friend of this show. Dick Criswell has passed away. And he is, of course, the man who is the head, was the head of IPUS. He was also the team leader for AlphaCom. But more than that, he was a great friend to the UFO community. He was a great friend to me, and he was a great friend to this show. And he has he's been very, very ill now for the past couple of years or so, and he passed away day before yesterday, I think. No, yesterday. Day before yesterday. Day before yesterday, he passed away. His funeral services will be in the morning, and you'll want to keep his family in your prayers. And I've been receiving, since we announced this last night, I've been receiving email from people expressing their condolences and sympathy for the family. And I will communicate those to Joan, his wife. But, you know, this time comes for all of us. It's not really so sad for those to whom it comes. But it is for those who are left behind. And appreciate everything that Dick Criswell did for this show. But he didn't just do it for this show. He did things all the time in behalf of UFO investigation and UFO disclosure. So some of you missed the announcement last night, and I just wanted to be sure that you heard the announcement. But he will, his funeral service will be in the morning. Now, let me very quickly say, for those of you who are brand new to the show, we have a free weekly newsletter. It's called the K-Files. And you just go to my website, and you'll see where it says K-Files right in the middle of the screen. Click that, and you can subscribe. You're going to get a confirmation email that has a link in it that you have to click in order for you to be able to activate your subscription. And it depends on your email program as to whether that link is clickable or not. You may have to copy it and then just paste that into your browser. And then that will activate your subscription. My guest this evening is Stan Deo. He's been a guest with us before and always fascinating. We'll be back right after this.
Come on.
welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, as I said just before we went to break, is Stan Deo. Now, Stan Deo is someone that I think just about all of you are familiar with. You've read his books. You've seen him on video, DVDs. You've seen him perhaps on television. Particularly if you live in Australia, perhaps you've seen him on television because there was a series of shows that he did. And I believe, if I'm wrong, he can correct me, but I believe that was in Perth, Australia. Well, I don't know what's happened, Stan, are you still with us?
Yeah, still here.
You're still with us. Okay, well, let's push this button. Okay. Pilot error, I just pushed the wrong button. During the break, Stan, we were making a joke about remembering. Stan told me some things about me, and I said, well, you've got a great memory, and are you take great notes? And he said, great notes at my age, great memory is a luxury. Well, at my age, punching the right buttons is a luxury.
Hey, Kevin, your voice level has dropped down. I can hardly hear you now, so you need to push another button.
Well, okay, how's that? Is that any better?
No.
No? Well, I don't. I guess the equipment's not going to cooperate tonight. I don't guess it's going to get any better.
Well, I shall have to listen closely.
Well, during the next break, we'll try to find some way around that.
Is my voice level okay at your end, though?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, your voice level is fine.
All right.
Okay. In fact, I've got you turned up, got my volume turned up so high now that we're getting a little bit of feedback, so...
Don't do that. Back it off a bit, because I'll just listen carefully.
Well, it's not cooperating with me, but anyway. All right. But Stan, this series of TV shows that you did in Australia, that was in Perth, was it not?
That's correct, it was.
And what was that series about?
Well, it was a series... called UFOs Are Here, and then it became Deo UFOs and You, and then UFOs Are Back, I think. That was the three titles of the series. And it started out basically the first program, UFOs Are Here. They started filming that program, and the British director did probably months before they approached me. And it was only because of an accident that I met one of their producers on the show, and at some other function, and he said, "Oh, that you've been involved in some of this. That's quite interesting." And I, thought, well, that's the end of the conversation. And few days passed, and this guy shows up in my front yard that I'd talked to, that producer, and he said, "Look, we'd like for you to come down over to Channel 9 here in Perth and participate in our special." So I went over and I talked to Guy Baskin, who was the director of the whole thing, and the British director, and I was impressed with what they'd researched. They had interviewed Steven Spielberg and Alan Hynek and all the leading lights of the field at the time. So they took me out to the producer's house and filmed it there in his living room, because they didn't want anybody to channel to see what I was saying, until it was time for air. And that's when I started, kind of revealing what I'd been doing in the past and about the cover-up. Before that, I just talked privately. I hadn't done anything publicly. And, of course, after the show went to air, it rated so high they'd never had anything rate like that. They did the other two shows as a sequel to that. But that then caused a publishing company over in Melbourne to ring me up and say, "Look, we want you to do a book, and we'll supply you a ghostwriter." And I said, "Well, okay." And burned out three ghostwriters. It was too hard for them. And then I got my contract back from the publishers, and I thought, well, I've got all these notes and stuff here. I suppose I ought to pretend like I'm an author and write a book. And so I wrote The Cosmic Conspiracy, which was kind of a runaway bestseller down there and in Europe, and eventually it's been selling well here in the United States as well when they would allow it to be sold.
Is it still available?
Yeah, it was out of print for a while. I'd done, probably 15 editions of it, and earlier this year, in January, I got this incredible urge to update it with something I'd been kind of sniffing around in the book of Daniel in the Bible. I'd been retranslating, very laboriously I might add, retranslating some ancient Chaldean, Aramaic, and Arabic and Hebrew, some of the words that were found in the book of Daniel, trying to understand a couple of passages that dealt with the alien seed not mixing with the seed of man. That was in particularly in Daniel chapter 2, verses 41 through 44, where it was talking about the clay and iron toes of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. And also later in the book in chapter 11, 36 through 39, I went to there to translate those four verses as well again, because it had to do with the world leader of this time and his connection to the quote-unquote alien god that Daniel spoke of. And so then I thought, right, when I dug into it and started finding out everything I found, the hair in the back of my neck was standing up most days. I'd say, Holly, listen to this. You know, look what I just found here. And so I realized I had to get that cosmic conspiracy book back in the market, because I needed to have what I said in the book to start with there, and then add to it what I'd found out now. So I did that and reprinted, I think it was in April, May this year, and it's still going like gangbusters. People are understanding what I'm saying, and there's a warning in there from Daniel that was hidden for several thousand years, and I'm sure there's more in there. I just haven't had time to use the method I translate with to get at it. Mm-hmm. And Kevin, I might add here, I'm not a formally trained translator. I learned a lot of this myself and studying with rabbis who were teaching rabbis, so that I could translate these things this way. And you don't use like Strong's Concordance and stuff like that. You actually break the words apart into pieces, and you look at the source of the words, the origin, what language they're supposed to be in and what language they are in. And there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work in history, looking up stuff. Daniel mentioned something about a place called Tinah, T-I-N-A-H. He didn't call it so much a place as the clay of Tinah when he was mentioning it, and I had to go dig up and do a lot of search for this place called Tinah. And then when I found it, I understood what he was saying. But so that's, I guess that's why it takes me so long. I'm not really formally trained in that, but I've certainly been impressed with what I've seen.
You've been doing some other writing as well. You're writing a, as I understand it, you're writing a paper that's going to be published, and it has to do with one of the great mysteries, really, in astronomy, and that is, when we look at the sun, all the planets seem to orbit the sun basically around its equator. When we look at the Earth, the moon orbits the Earth basically around its equator. And the same thing is true of the moons around Jupiter and so forth, and Saturn. And so, but the question for astronomers would be, well, why is that? And you have come up with an explanation for why that is. Am I correct?
That's correct, Kevin. It is one of several mysteries that I've been curious about for most of my life. And certainly, as you point out, if gravity is basically the same all over a star surface or a planet or whatever, then why do the planets have to orbit at its equator? Why can't they orbit around its poles and that kind of stuff? And, I puzzled over that for many years until in the last couple of years, I got serious about modeling this in mathematics and in animations. And then I suddenly realized that I had the answer to that. But not only that, I had an expansion of our knowledge of what we call gravity. It would appear to be the only force in the universe we've discovered that is one-directional, doesn't have anti-gravity per se, or like negative gravity around. It's just gravity. But But that's not true. And what I've done and what I'm doing in this paper, I'm still writing it, is not only am I putting animations in there, you know, 3D in space, you know, with planets and stars to show you how these things swirl in a vortex to form a planet or a star or a galaxy, I'm showing you the mathematics of how orbits form around, say, a star, and they not necessarily have a moon or in the case of the sun, a planet in it. There are some empty orbits between the sun and the outer reaches. First one is between Mercury and Venus, another between Mars and the asteroid belt, and then between the asteroid belt and Jupiter. There's probably five empty orbits that don't have planets, but they could sustain them. Planets can only orbit where they are, you know, unless you kick them real hard and kick them into another stable orbit. They don't orbit in between those spaces, and so I've addressed this, and the simplest way to explain it over the radio would be to say, if you've ever watched a drop of water splash in slow motion and the waves that go out from it, mm-hmm. and how they form ripples at certain intervals, that basically is how gravity works. It's like splash waves going out into the fluid of space and reflecting back, and they form a standing wave pattern, which is an orbit. And then something can be in that orbit if there was dust in there when something shocked the solar system to cause it to start to spin in that orbit. It eventually coalesced into a planet. But in doing this, I realize there's two kinds of gravity. There's the gravity that's in atoms, you know, all the atoms and stuff, they spin and they have gravity. And then there's the gravity of the planet they form, say like the atoms of Earth. If all those atoms are lined up in a certain direction, then their gravitational pull will be stronger than if they were random. So there's an organizing gravitational force, which is larger and slower, and it's like a spinning vortex, like a spinning tornado in space, and the Earth is the center of it. And it's two of those tornadoes hitting point to point, which form a planet. And so the big vortex that's organizing the planet gets all the little atoms that are like little gyroscopes to orient a certain way relative to these two vortices. And so I thought, well, this is dumb. I mean, you know, this can't possibly be the story. I will run some tests with electricity and wires and batteries and stuff and see if I can get an electric interaction with gravity. And sure enough, I did some tests, which I put in part one of the Gemstone Scrolls. I've already published that part. And I left the equations there, showed how it all worked. And now then I'm going to extend that, showing the last part that I did, where I did an experiment with wire, with just number 28-gauge wire, and I pulsed a direct current through it in the northern hemisphere and then had it done in the southern hemisphere several times. And I reversed the current and did it, and it showed me that electricity twists the wire in opposite directions in the northern and southern hemisphere. And this is because I'm pretty sure the gravity is aligning the atoms. So we're pretty excited about this, and of course, the solving the mystery of the Hawking's paradox about the supermassive black holes, you know, that they suck in stuff and energy and mass, but they don't put anything out, but yet they do, because they're periodic.
Well, explain that to us. What do you mean, yes, they do, because they're periodic?
Sorry, Kevin, say that again?
Yeah, explain that to us. What do you mean, yes, they do put something out because they're periodic?
Oh, sorry. I'm having a bit of hay fever here today for some reason. Excuse me. The supermassive black holes are in every galaxy at the center of every galaxy. They've pretty well confirmed that now in astronomy. The supermassive black holes get so gravitationally strong that they pull in even light so it can't escape, and they suck it in. So what happens to it after it gets sucked into a supermassive black hole? Well, basically, a supermassive black hole is a spinning part of space, the fluid space, that is spinning so fast that the inertia of things that are caught on its surface get pulled into its polar regions and down inside of it, where they become compressed. Now, this compression reaches a point where inside the supermassive black hole it gets so hot that it has to release that energy, and the only place it can release it is out the poles, and so you get jets of gamma radiation, all kinds of stuff coming out the north and south pole of a supermassive black hole. Now, then we've noticed in other galaxies where it's not there, but then in others where it started. And in our own galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, looking at it, they found, surprise, surprise, it is starting to re-emit. They thought our supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy was dormant, but it's now starting to emit, gather stuff in to emit. So it's like if you have a glass of water and a few little tea leaves in it, and you can stir it up real fast with your spoon, get the spoon out of the way. There's a little vortex that's spinning around in the center of the glass. You hold it up to the sun. You're looking at a couple of tea leaves down at the bottom of that vortex. And then as it starts to slow down, you notice the tip of the vortex bobs up and down, until finally it stops spinning. That up and down bobbing is, in a way, parallel to what happens in supermassive black holes, under my hypothesis. And that is that periodically it has to release energy and then stop and recollect more energy and compress it and then reach that explosion point and then blow it out the polar regions, which might be a way to recreate matter in its basic form in gamma and positron, electron, masses, which are nothing more than spinning vortices in the fluid of space. Anyway, I'm trying to explain a complex thing with words. I'm not doing well. I know that, but
I think you're doing quite well. You're doing good.
That's why I'm to the point of sorry.
Yeah, you're doing fine. Okay, so the deal is that black holes, the theory that they suck everything in and nothing ever comes out, that's simply not true.
That's not true. That's true. And Hawking, Dr. Stephen Hawking. Probably 15, 20 years ago, had put out the Hawking paradox, etc., saying that all this happens and information is lost once it gets inside a black hole. The information of form, matter, and mass, etc., is lost. So therefore, we have a quandary. And the physics community, the cosmological research, astronomers, everybody were saying, "Oh, that's wrong," and they've tried various ways to prove he was wrong. And a couple years back, he came out and he said, "Look, I've got a solution to all this. I was right." But the information isn't lost. It goes into a parallel universe, and we have an infinite number of parallel universes. So they've been inventing things to, solve the problem, which gets way out of the ballpark. It's as simple as watching raindrops splash in a pond, or a little puddle of water right in front of you so you can see the little beads of water dance up on the top of the water. And it's as simple as watching that glass of clear water with tea leaves in it spin. It's vortexual mechanics, and you can see those things. That's why I've generated these animations, so that people can see what I'm talking about, rather than having to relate to the equation, although I do give those.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Folks, let me explain something to you, and then we'll get back to our guest, Stan Deo. The deal is this. You can hear me just fine, and you can hear Stan Deo just fine. And I can hear him just fine. For some reason, during the break, we hung up, and I called him on a different telephone line. But with the same results. He can barely hear us. That happens sometimes. It's not our equipment. It's when we are being interfered with. And how do I know it's not the equipment? Because I make test calls during the day to make sure everything is spiffy for the show. And I do that every day. And it checked out just fine, no problem. And then now that we're on the air, he's having difficulty hearing us. But we'll get through this together. Stan, let me try just one more thing. And folks, if you will, just kind of park for a moment and enjoy this test, all right? Let me just try just one more thing here. Okay, can you hear me any better, Stan?
No, it didn't change.
Didn't change, okay. All right, well, we will just work with what we've got and get through it. All right, now let me ask you this, Stan. This work that you've been doing, you discovered that gravity has two forces and not one. Does this have any application, or can you foresee it having any application in the development of anti-gravity propulsion?
Oh, most certainly. What I'm going to publish in this next paper, considering that I'm allowed to publish it, is this simple test, as I said, you can do with a car battery.
Yeah.
About 40 feet of number 28 gauge wire.
Mm-hmm.
And a wall about 20 feet away, 15, 20 feet away, and a little laser pointer and some stuff like that, and show people that wires, the atoms in wires, are polarized. Everything in our gravitational field is oriented a certain way in its normal state, because it's like a bunch of little spinning gyroscopes, these atoms are. And they tend to align at their path of least resistance. And the test that I'm going to show will not make, will not give you a design for an anti-gravity craft, but it will show you that electricity directly interacts with the quote-unquote gravitational field of atoms and the Earth. Now, once you understand that, then, and you've seen what I've put on, or somebody else put on YouTube of a lecture I did in Roswell in 2005, then you will have the basis for understanding how to possibly build your own little test circuit for anti-gravity. To get away from anti-gravity just a second, but to get back to gravity as two forces, under the hypothesis that I've constructed, which I believe is correct from years ago when I worked in an organization that was developing that, is that gravity on the surface of the Earth appears to point down toward the center of the Earth, but that if you were to drill a hole magically from the surface of the Earth down to the core, that when you got down a few hundred miles, that gravity would weaken, and suddenly be going backwards, back up toward the surface. And that there would be a void at that point, and then another sphere of matter, which might be what they call the nickel iron core or cadmium core of the planet or whatever, but that the planet, in essence, may have a hollow shell around a harder, more dense core. And from that respect, then, the bidirectionality of gravity means that there are waves pushing out from a planet or a star or whatever, and waves reflecting back from space, because in essence, in space terms, the vortex that makes gravity is spinning with such energy that it reflects back from the water around it. And if you find that hard to conceive, imagine when you're at the beach and you take your flat hand and you hit the surface of the water very fast. Now, when you hit it fast, the faster you hit it, the harder it hurts your hand. I mean, it gets to be like a brick if you hit it too hard.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a skier on the back of a boat, when you're skiing at certain speeds, you feel like you're running over solid material rather than the water. And so when things around planets or stars, this fluid space, which is centered at the core of a planet or a star or a moon, when that thing is spinning fast enough relative to space around it, the space around it seems like it's hard, like a wall, and the energy reflects back in. And when it does, the waves coming back in from space and the waves going out from the spinning vortex meet, and where they meet and form a null is where a ring forms, where you can have a planet or a moon or even a star in a galactic formation. I guess I drifted a bit there, but anyway, did I answer the question?
Yeah, but now I have another question.
Okay.
Now where these two waves of gravity meet and develop this null or a void is where you can have a planet. How then can the planet existing in that null or void have gravity?
Because it has its own spinning field, which was created when it was created. It's what made it, because if you imagine that you have these nulls or voids, they are null or voids as far as moving in or out from the center of the sun. But the edge closest to the sun is moving faster than the edge furthest away in that null zone. And so if it were filled with cosmic dust in the beginning, and another large mass either hit the solar system and cramped its rings, you know, like crimped them a bit, or if some other heavy mass came in and hit several of the orbital rings that had dust in it, because it hit and both sides of that ring have different velocities, it would cause it to spin. And as it spun, it would start to form a vortex, which would then start sweeping up like a vacuum cleaner. As it went around the sun, it would sweep up all the loose dust particles, forming a larger and larger mass, and filling the shells that this spiraling field is creating.
Okay.
I'm waving my hands a lot here. You can't see. Trying to explain.
That's okay. That's okay. All right. So how would this apply to being able to develop anti-gravity propulsion?
Well, once you know that gravity is a function of spin, and all gravitational masses, wherever they are, do have spin. It's either in their molecules or atoms, or it's in the main body. Once you understand that, then you start looking for a way to develop a series of electrical coils, which will produce one vector that's not balanced, so that you can push against the gravitational wave coming off the planet or coming toward it. In the early days, the first reported flying saucer, Donald Kehoe, when he reported that, reported that they looked, the fleet of them looked like they were leaves bobbing on an ocean or something as they went over the mountains. And the reason for that, I'm pretty sure, was that once you set a gravitational field on your craft, which is just this pulse DC spinning field, once you set it at a certain energy level, it will fly from point to point where the gravity is of the value you set it against, you know, the anti-gravity against a certain gravity. Well, the field of gravity varies on the top of a mountain versus down at the bottom of a seabed. And so what happens is that craft flies the equal value gravity components wherever it goes, and that's why it has that fluttering leaf look when it's going over mountains. It's flying the gravity wave rather than the altitude that you would do with an altimeter. In fact, I don't even know how they would easily do that, to fly straight and level over such a vast distance with the gravitational field being so different. But anyway, it'd be a little bit of a bumpy ride, I suppose. Unless you had inside the craft, which they do, a field that goes through the craft and the crew so that they're all one, and the craft doesn't get bounced around any more than the crew, because they do it together and are uniformly accelerated, which is another physics principle. But I will be able to show people enough with this next paper that for the serious researchers, they can start to experiment with pulsed DC coils to generate a gravitational field, and hence an anti-gravity field if they reverse the polarity of it. That's my purpose. It's not to bring down governments or any of that kind of stuff. It is simply to share the concept so that our engineers or young physicists, whatever, can start to take a different direction than we've been going, and that the knowledge base will gradually improve out there. And hopefully by the time that it starts to develop in public, the threat of world governments and terrorists and things will be passed.
Well, that stuff, I don't know when it will be passed, but I don't think it has a much longer shelf life. I don't see it as being able to survive a whole lot longer. But and I hope I'm right about that. But as you build up this, for lack of a better term, I'll just use my layman's vocabulary here. As you build up an anti-gravity side to push against the gravity side, if you have a human in the middle of that, aren't you doing something that sort of unspins him atomically?
Well, basically, all you do is orient his atoms to your field. And to him, there's local gravity within the craft. It may not be down if the thing is, like, say, a saucer craft is, you know, parallel to the surface of the Earth. His gravity field may not be down toward the Earth. It may be sideways or whatever. But because he and the craft, the crew and the craft, are in the same field, all their atoms get aligned to that field. And you can pump energy into that field over a period of time, over minutes or hours, if you wish. And you can become so energetic in there that time passes at a different rate for you than it does for those on the outside. You can slow down time for yourself, or you can speed it up in there. This is explaining why we don't really violate the Lorentz Fitzgerald transform or the Einstein thing about you can't exceed the speed of light. You can. There is not a limit there, really. And to allow that equation to work, you have to say that the time spent in dissipating or changing energy levels is drawn out. Instead of being a second, it might be microseconds, or it might be 10 seconds. But time does change. The passage of time does change inside of a field of a craft like that versus that which is around the Earth at the moment. You can approach the speed of light in vibrating your atoms or spinning your atoms. You don't have to go in a straight line. You can stand still and spin something until the waves coming out are reaching that velocity. And there are a number of little things like this that people kind of don't think about, or if they do, it's too hard and they leave it be. But, you know, if you're going to turn a corner at 20,000 miles an hour in a craft, you know, one of these anti-gravity craft, if you did it normally, like, you know, a jet, and tried to turn the corner at that speed, you'd break the jet into pieces, and of course you'd kill the crew from the gravitational or G-forces as you go around that corner. But if you'll notice, a lot of the alleged UFOs, the bright lights that stand still in the sky or come zipping in and then do a right-angle turn, when they do that right-angle turn, there's a slight change in the brilliance of the light coming out of the craft at the point they make the turn, and inside the craft, so that they can make the turn without breaking themselves, they pump the energy density, and to them, you go into slow motion while they're going fast time, and you're playing cards and whatever, and your craft is now turning the corner, but outside, it looks like you've turned it bang in a fraction of a second.
Okay, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Stan Deo. And Stan, when we went away for break, you were describing for us how this works so that the crew inside of a UFO doesn't feel that high speed, high G force if they make one of those right angle turns.
Right. Another example I use of that, which is perhaps easier to understand, is that the time spent in turning that corner, if you could stretch it out for the crew many times what it would appear to be to the naked eye, they could withstand the change at, say, one gravity. And I use the example, suppose you take a big titanium hollow spherical ball, right, and inside that you put another titanium ball big enough to hold a man. If he puts himself up against the side of the smaller ball, where his feet are at the bottom of the ball and his head is at the top, so he's lopsided in there, and you fill that titanium ball with, very thick oil, the bigger ball. So you've got a little ball with a guy in it floating inside of a bigger ball with oil in there, and you throw him off of a 50-story building. And he falls down to the ground, bang! But because it's titanium, it doesn't bend and warp, and it allows the guy inside the small sphere inside to spin around rapidly, because he's lopsided in there weight-wise. He spins around rapidly and slowly slows down as the heat of the friction of the oil is radiated out through the other titanium shell outside, and eventually comes to a stop. Now, instead of smashing him flat because he's reduced his velocity to zero in such a short time, like you'd normally do if you jumped off a 50-story building, they've allowed him to amortize the change of his inertia or speed, to amortize that over, say, 2 or 3 minutes. And that way you're saying, well, there's 200 times, you know, less impact on him because we're letting him amortize his slowdown and dissipate that amortization as heat, you know, frictional heat. Now, that is a simple way to look at what I'm talking about inside these crafts, so that the atoms of the crew in the craft are allowed to turn that corner over, say, 5 minutes, their time, but it's only half a second, our time. But to do that means that, of course, they continue to age, the crew and the craft do, at that time. So you can see why they probably don't do a lot of turns unless they have to, or if they're slow, they can turn gradual turns and do the flutter leaf effects. But when they're going somewhere in a hurry and want to change direction, they have to lose or age a little bit more than the rest of us because they've got to cram it into that time dilation. But that's why we can still use the Einstein-type equations, but we're allowing the change of direction to compress time. And time, a little t in the Einstein equations there, that little t is what the secret is. If you allow the change to occur at sub-t's or multiples of t, it will allow you to use those same equations and explain what's happening.
Anyway. Okay, now I ask about any applications for anti-gravity, but based on what you're telling us now, let me ask you, are there applications here for time travel?
Yes. Now, as far as backward time travel, I'm not sure that we can do that. Certainly forward time travel, you could invert the field density so that to the people inside the craft, everybody outside would be moving very fast, and the energy levels of the crew and the craft would be so low, the spin energies, that they would age very slowly, yet they would age. And 100 years or 1,000 years may pass, and they would then be, you know, when they energize their field to normalize to the surrounding atoms, they would be on the same time frame as we are, or whoever is there in 200 or 300 years. But they couldn't come back, as far as I know. And believe me, I didn't create the universe and don't maintain it, so there may be a secret way to do that. But from where I stand with physics at this point and the entropy of the universe, you know, the running down of it, I think we could go forward in time but not go back. Now, this has some real advantages. For instance, say you've got someone that's very important to the community, and they have a terminal illness that can't be cured right now. You could build a stasis room for them where you would remove the energy from them, you know, the spin of their atoms, and slow them down by our standards, and they would not progress in their sickness anywhere near as fast as they would if they were on the outside. And so years may go by, and a solution may be found to save those people. They'll bring them out of the stasis chamber then, or the slow chamber, and bring them up to normal speed and fix them, or go inside the thing and fix them inside there. So you can see that, and another thing might happen. Suppose you had to have an immediate decision that required a group of men or women to vote on something at a national level or a global level, you know, the economy or some important decision, a war. If you had one of these situation rooms where you could put them into fast time, you put them in there, you change their energy density on their atoms, and suddenly they're in there working like crazy, and to the outsiders who let them go into that room and shut the door, that war room, they've only been in there a couple of seconds or a minute, and yet inside they may have spent, you know, 10 hours trying to analyze the best way to solve a certain problem. And then they can open the door and come out a minute or two later, and they've spent a day or two, or even longer, in the box, doing what they need to do to provide an answer as best they could for the situation. So there are a lot of applications that you could use time dilation for. Whether it's going to work to go back in time or not, well, I don't know. That's Back to the Future, isn't it?
Yeah, well, now two questions come to mind immediately. Number one, Do you think that such technology exists now? Is it in use now? And number two, what effect, if any, would this have on your DNA?
Okay. First of all, yes, the technology is available now, not to the public, but within a number of high-priority projects that are not made public. The effect on DNA, I'm not sure. I've never heard that that issue brought up. When I was inducted into the research program into Dr. Teller's group back in 71, I was told at that time, they volunteered it, that they already had antigravity. And I mentioned in the Cosmic Conspiracy, I believe it's in there, isn't it? Yes, about a book called, or a short story called Noise Level. And Noise Level was a short story written back in that time in the 50s by a popular science fiction writer. It might have been Ray Bradbury, I'm just trying to remember. Anyway, where he talks about how they encouraged the scientists and engineers of the day to develop antigravity. They first had to believe that it existed, and someone else had beat them to it, and so then they would find a way to make antigravity, which they did do. I was just trying to find my notes on that. It's been so long since I've looked at the story, but anyway, it was called Noise Level, and it does tell names companies like Glenn Martin, Gluharov Helicopter, just lots of companies that were well known back in 1957-58 in the story, and shows how they discovered finally the antigravity. And it came to one of the engineers when he'd taken a weekend off to go fishing in the middle of the research project, and he was watching the swirls or the vortices of water in the stream and how they behaved when they came close together or when something fell into them and that kind of stuff. And he jumped up and said, I have the answer, and went back, and he and his team eventually made a 30-foot diameter aluminum disc rise up off the floor an inch. And everybody was pleased as punch. It wasn't as compact as what they'd been shown that had already been developed. And when they took their findings to the Defense Department to say, yes, all right, we finally discovered what you said was there, the Defense Department guys say, look, we lied. We made a movie and a character and an actor to show a small portable backpack that would make him float before it blew up. And we knew that if you knew it or thought it was possible, that you would remove the noise level from your mind and you would focus on the solution to antigravity, which they did. Now, in 1957, the New York Herald Tribune ran a series of articles on the companies doing research in antigravity in the United States. And it was a who's who of the aeronautical industry at the time. And I reproduced that in detail. You know, I just photostated it, and I also typed it out in the back of the Cosmic Conspiracy to show people, look, this is where we were in 1957 before the secrecy curtain went down. And so, yes, we do have antigravity, and I'm sure a lot more technologies than that, which have been around since the probably the latest 1958-59. And then, of course, when I was inducted in the program, they told me they had it. And although that wasn't my department, they volunteered that. So, anyway, it's...
All right, so I have no problem at all with the idea that we have antigravity. But the question that I would have is, what about the time machine? And we'll get to that after this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stan Deo, and we are continuing to, during the breaks, work on trying to get it where Stan can hear me a little better, and I think he can hear me a little bit better now. Stan, when we went off to break, we were talking about, you were talking to us about the fact that we have anti-gravity. And I have no problem at all believing that we have antigravity. But what about this time dilation? Do we have a time machine?
Well, not in the Hollywood sense where you can go anywhere in time or like Doctor Who back and forwards, but I do believe we can dilate time for, you know, inside of a room or a craft. And, you know, what the long-term effects of it physiologically and psychologically are, I don't know. But I think we can travel one way forward in time, like forward, like you normally do, but faster than everyone else. And using that that belief, you could look at beings that were on the Earth, say, back in the time of Atlantis, with one of these devices or a craft like that. Hypothetically, they could energize that field in such a manner that they travel forward in time, say in a cave somewhere, just sitting still, travel forward in time, aging very slowly, and then it re-energizes the field at a specific point to our level, and pop out here, being only a few years or weeks or whatever older than they were back 5,000-6,000 years ago. So in that respect, yes, it's a time-traveling machine. It allows you to go great distances ahead in time with little aging to yourself or the equipment on board.
Would it, well, I ask you, you know, would it make changes in your DNA? I would suspect if you were doing this time dilation, that playing the flip side of the record, where you were speeding up things for you, and then popping back into this time, we would see the signs of aging on you. And the reason I bring that up is because, have you ever noticed how really fast someone ages after they become president?
Yes, yes, I have. And even Obama's getting gray hairs now.
Mm-hmm.
I've wondered.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, certainly I've wondered about that, and I've looked at certain people that should be a certain age, younger looking, and in the program, and they were very old, as though the weight of the world was on them, and wrinkles and gray hair early. And I've often wondered if they'd been, you know, off traveling in these craft or in the rooms. And I mean, let's face it, suppose you could generate a holiday spot, maybe it wouldn't have sun and darkness at the same rate it does here, but suppose you could incorporate a large area into a field like that under a mast antenna of some sort. You might find that it's a haven. You can go in there and live and do and enjoy and raise a family and come back out, and you've only been gone a couple of months on the outside world, but you would have aged while you had that family.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, people look at me and say, "You're how old?" And they say, "You look a lot younger." And I say, "Well, you know, it's traveling the craft. It does it, you know."
I'm still looking for someone to come up with a machine where, you know, I can go back in time to when I had hair and then come back here with that hair.
Well, now that's a noble pursuit.
a little trite, maybe.
Well, I understand. It's something I've wondered about, but as I said to one guy, a physicist, I was having a glass of wine with at a party, and he was pontificating about this and that, and, you know, that God didn't exist and stuff. And I said, "You know, you ever see Doctor Who?" "Yeah, oh, sure, yeah." And the time cabinet he's in there, you know, the police box, and how he travels back in time. I said, "Think about this. If there is no God, and a man at some future point here on Earth or wherever develops a time cabinet so that he can go back in time and fix anything, including his own aging process and that kind of stuff, then from that moment on, there always was a God, and there is a God, because he would be in charge of everything, because he could make everything fit like he wanted, couldn't he?" This usually left him going for another drink rather rapidly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the reason that my hair is just a fringe benefit. Okay. There's almost nothing on top, and it's just a fringe around the sides and the back.
Right.
Now, when I was international police, I kept that shaved. So I was bald-headed, really bald-headed.
Right.
And but when I met my wife, who is Thai, and we started dating, and I had asked her to marry me. She told me I had to let my hair grow out because she wouldn't marry me as long as I was bald-headed. I said, why not? She said, because you look like a monk.
Of course. It's now, Thai is Myanmar now, isn't it?
No. Myanmar is what used to be Burma.
Oh yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Thailand, the ancient name was Siam. So, and you'll still see things there that are named Siam. But do you know what the name Thai means?
No.
It means free.
Free?
Free. Thailand is free land. That's what it means.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, what we're going to do is open up the telephone lines and invite you to join with us in this discussion. We're talking about anti-gravity. We're talking about time dilation and, if you will, in a way, time travel. My guest is Stan Deo, and Stan has quite a history. I'll use my description, and if that's not exactly correct, Stan, forgive me, and you can correct it. But Stan was formerly kind of an insider with the New World Order people. And he's a scientist, a physicist. He's an architect, a marine architect, formerly undercover with the FBI. He's got, quite a history. And for these past several years now, Stan has been speaking out about these exotic technologies and the fact that they do exist. They're not theory. They do exist. And he's been talking about the cover-up, where it's coming from, and how they do it. And, Stan, let me just ask you, why do they do it?
Well, probably several generations back, even in the 1700s, there were very wealthy people on the earth who had so much money that they would probably never ever run out. And at that point, when you get that much money, power becomes the thing that you seek the most, and power over people and things and events that you can control the environment, or not the global environment, but the environment of the world that people live in, you know, the economic situation, political situation, that kind of environment, the social environment, and which is, of course, linked to the environmental thing itself. But anyway, this group of people they were in different places, some in Europe, some in England, and eventually the United States was settled and started, and then they thought, right, well, we're going to move part of our organization over there and infiltrate America from the start, and we're going to generate movements globally that will eventually bring us to a one-world population, a one-world nation, if you wish, so that whether you're black, white, Muslim, Hebrew, Christian, whatever, that you will all get along on the planet. And there will be one kind of philosophy that's uniform for the planet, and one economy, and one law, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they had great dreams about bringing peace to the earth. I really do believe they thought they were doing the right thing in the beginning. But where it went wrong in the late 1700s is they started to get into the occult sciences, the mysticism of like demons and satanic worship. They called him Lucifer, the bright morning star, they called him. But anyway, these powerful groups started to go off track into this kind of dark philosophy, and their objectives then became not so much altruistic as world dominance, and it was a battle for men's souls, in essence, because this went back to the old biblical some of the Eastern religions' teachings that man has a soul and it lives on after we leave this body. And it was for control of these in a massive confrontation. It was occurring somewhere out there or around us, but in a different dimension or whatever. And so I looked into that way early in the game to see what was happening. Why were these people doing this and siding with what was obviously a dark force? And it was simply because they had allowed themselves to be convinced that they didn't have to follow rules and order, and that they could set their own rules and order for the planet, and that there was no real God except Lucifer. And that was their big mistake, because they sided with the rebellion against the true creator and sustainer of all that we know, according to the ancient writings. I mean, I haven't met him personally, but that's...
Okay, so why the cover-up, though?
That's where we are now, then, is in the settling of this massive rebellion that occurred against the creator, the Elohim, as the Hebrew calls it. You know, and this rebellion started thousands, if not tens of thousands of years ago, somewhere out there, either in a parallel universe or, you know, phase shifted from us, but where we can't see it directly, but a whole civilization. Massive, in fact. And I think the reason they've been holding the technology back, and the reason they've been setting up this one-world government, these bankers and industrialists, these power brokers of the planet, is that they have believed a lie, and they because they wanted to, and joined with the rebellion against the established order, God, the Elohim. And that's why I think we're going to see things come out in the open here in the next year, even, about the quote-unquote alien presence, which would be nothing more than the ones that were kicked out in the rebellion from wherever they live. The Bible speaks of several levels, at least three, maybe seven levels to existence, which implies parallel universes. And
all right.
This is going to be resolved very shortly. So I'm excited to live in this time for that reason. Not that I want to see people suffer, but I do want to see the end of this rebellion and the chaos and the beginning of a unified planet under a true benevolent, you know, leader, a king. And I don't think that we're going to get that first. We'll get the bad guys first, which will have to be kicked out of office by the true Messiah or the king of this planet. That's my opinion anyway.
Fair enough. All right, let's go to the telephone. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, Kevin, this is Rusty from Michigan.
Hi, Rusty.
Hi, Kevin. Hello, Stan.
Hi, Rusty. I can hear you just fine.
All right, great. Kevin, before I ask my question, was you aware your TV channel was not working?
No.
Yeah, I haven't been able to get you since the beginning of the show here in Michigan anyway.
Okay.
Okay. But, Stan, boy, you bring up so many questions. How can... I'm going to say a common guy like myself, I don't know all this physics stuff that you know. What? I mean, is this... You're talking about these parallel universes and even how this stuff intermixes with the Bible. How can I... How do you come up with this stuff?
Well, Rusty, it's been a lifetime of study, and mainly studying the Old Hebrew and... the New Testament as well, and some of the Greek, and then mixing that with physics, trying to understand what they were talking about. And if you'll recall, when the flaming chariot came to see Ezekiel, it came out of the sky, and it was hot and flaming, yet it didn't hurt him, and it came down to his level and talked to him and whatever. And if you think about, say, Jesus, when he was going to ascend, it was probably one of the books that's not in the standard canon, but I was reading where he was standing with his disciples before he was going to ascend on the mountain to go up into the heavens after he'd been raised from the dead, after he'd spent 40 days on earth. And his feet sparkled with lightning, like under his feet, as he started to lift up off the dirt and go up into the sky with Elijah and Moses, whoever he was going with. There are a number of these little clues that, you know, as a mathematician, a physicist, that kind of excited me. I said, well, what caused that? Why would that be? You know, of course, then Star Trek came along, and I realized, well, of course, that's like a teleporter. But until that moment, though, I was still thinking that about energy densities, differences, why did God appear in the skies, even though in the Exodus he was a funnel of fire by night and a funnel of cloud by day? And when Moses said, I want to see your face and what you look like up on the mountain, God says, well, I can't really do that, because if I do, my presence will destroy you, just the energy of my presence. But I'll project my image up on this cloud as a shadow so you can see my outline, and that way you won't get hurt. And this immediately reminded me, okay, this where God is or came from or where he was at that moment, his energy density was so great that even though he wasn't burning and the craft or whatever he was using wasn't burning, it looked to us like it was burning the air around him because it was so energetic. And I said, well, that's got to be like a parallel universe. And sure enough, there was levels spoken of in the New Testament and some of the old Hebrew writings. And so I'm still open to discussion. I certainly haven't closed my mind about how it works, but they talk about a level beneath us where he descended into hell, or to I'm trying to think of the word, the other word,
Tartarus.
Anyway,
Hades.
Yeah, Tartarus. And that was down inside. And we know that people are going to be cast, or the Satan particularly knows, are going to be cast into a bottomless pit where there's a lake of fire. Well, in my researches of late, when I've been studying physics, not Bible, I developed this theory I was talking about earlier in the show about spin waves and that kind of stuff, and it does allow and does kind of dictate that there will be shells, voids within planets and other cores within them, and that as you go deeper into a planet, it'll get hotter in these different shells. And I thought, right, what is a bottomless pit? The inside of a ball, sealed. And what happens when you get inside of that pit on one of the, like, into one of those voids, and you're facing the core of the planet, which is a boiling mass of nickel and iron and cadmium, all those metals, I guess a lake of fire. But, you know, I started to realize maybe what we're hearing from these people isn't just simple tales. It's real. Take it for face value of the word, that they were inside of a ball, bottomless pit, and there was no way out. And there was this burning lake of fire in the center of it, which would be the core of the planet. Oh, that could be here. Then I got to thinking, Rusty, you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Then I got to thinking, okay, there have been reports of ghosts appearing to people from time to time, and many of these appearances of the ghosts, the room gets cool, as though energy is being sucked out of the room into this being, you know, this entity appearing to someone in our level. I thought, right, if there was a level beneath us in energy, we would seem like the Lord's presence, you know, bright shining things, if they could punch through as a ghost. Well, what about angels or messengers coming from the upper levels to us? They are hot. They glow. They are bright. They're so bright we can hardly stand to look at them, according to the old records. So,
right.
Rusty, following these clues and trying to answer them in a logical fashion for me, I'm kind of an engineer physicist type, has led me to these conclusions. Did that answer the question?
Yeah. How would I use the, you say you don't use the strong so much, but you go a little bit beyond. Can you elaborate a little bit more?
Well, what I did is I went to Behrman House, that's Behrman House in New York, who distribute Jewish books on culture and tradition and on learning the language. And I bought from them the Sephardi self-teach manuals, which was only, you know, $20-$30 each, something like that, to teach myself to read the Hebrew alphabet, and then to know certain basic Hebrew words, and then to be able to take a Hebrew, Arabic, Chaldean lexicon, which has all the conjugations, all the adjectives, all the nouns, all the verbs, all those languages that were used in the Bible mixed in and explained in order. And that way, I could then very slowly look at a word or a name, take the first one or two characters of it, depending where the word breaks, and translate that from what was called the root three-letter verb in Hebrew or Arabic or, you know, in Chaldean Aramaic.
Right.
And so it took me, you know, and still does, weeks to take apart four verses even, because I go word by word, and inside the word I break it up in order to see what the whole cultural bias on that word was. Like, if I say to you, it's afternoon here, that's one word. You say, oh, afternoon. Okay, I understand that. I say, yeah, well, aft means that which follows, and nerves are connective, and noon is midday. So it's that which follows midday if you break the word apart. And that's what I did with names and with the storyline, particularly in the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, and found amazing things. When I studied the Exodus that way, we were able to find where the salty water miracle occurred, where Moses had just crossed the Reed Sea with Israel, and they had been going a few days, and everybody was thirsty, and there was no fresh water, and there was only the salt water pond. Well, we used some military tactical maps for that area, 1 to 100,000 maps, and we found out there was an underground flow of fresh snow water from the mountains inside the Sinai Peninsula that came underground to that very bunch of ponds, which were this right distance at traveling at 6 miles per hour. They were there, and the water, the fresh water, came up underneath all the salt water, which had blown in from the canal or from the Reed Sea, and it formed a salt water deposit. Well, the fresh water welled up underneath it, and it was lighter, but it didn't break through because of this heavy salt water layer kept it bottled in. So God tells Moses, go out there, get those young men to get this kind of tree and that kind of tree, and cut it down, and to throw those logs into the water, out into the water, and you will see it turn into fresh water. So when they did, these logs went out there and went ka-splash and broke the inversion layer, and the heavy salt water fell underneath the fresh water underneath and pushed the fresh water up. Right before their eyes, blue, clear, fresh water rose up above the salt water. And I've done this experiment in swimming pools with salt water bags and stuff to see how it happens. And that was a miracle. But it was a miracle using the resources and the rules of physics on this planet. So I got that, and so did the group in my church. We all say the Hebrew together. When we analyze that, that was just one of the many amazing things we found out about the Exodus, that, you know, if you could hear the real story of the Exodus, you'd go, wow, that's a good sci-fi story. Just tremendous stuff. And if you go to Behrman House and get the Sephardi self-teach manuals, you can do it. And it'll take you a few weeks, part-time, but it's a way to learn very easily. And it's, you know, at a primer level. I didn't go for anything exotic like all the super grammatical text and whatever. I just went for the basic thing so I could look up a word in Hebrew, I could break it apart, and I could look at my analytical lexicon. I'm just trying to see who it was. It's the, anyways, by Johnson, I think. But anyway, it has been what I use to translate everything and to find out all these things, and you can do it. I would suggest you do it with some friends that are interested in it so you can help each other, but it didn't take long, I think 12, 13 weeks, and we were into it.
Okay, Rusty, I want to thank you for your call and excellent, interesting answer from Stan Deo. But now, ladies and gentlemen, we have to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stan Deo, and Stan is talking with us about a lot of different things. The telephone lines are open. We started out talking about anti-gravity. We talked about time dilation, and in response to Rusty's call, he explained how he came to the conclusions that he has come to on some things. Using the ancient languages and breaking the words apart. The telephone number, if you wish to give us a call, is 623-444-5889. That will work anywhere on planet Earth. 623-444-5889. Toll-free in the USA and Canada, the telephone number is 888-223-4599. Now, if you are outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, I don't have a toll-free number out there, in the rest of the world, because frankly, there's no such thing as a toll-free international number. Tried to find it. They don't have it. So what I've got for folks who are not in the USA or Canada, you can call our main number, 623-444-5889. Or if you don't wish to make the international long-distance call, what you can do is go to my website, scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show, and to the right of that is a link that says Flash Message. Now, that's for folks who are not in the USA or Canada. If you're in the USA or Canada, please use our telephones, okay? All right, Stan, we have a call coming in, so let's go straight to the telephone. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Oh, it's Heidi from Manitoba.
Hello, Heidi.
Hello, Kevin. Heidi. Hi, Stan. Hi. I had two questions. Stan, I was wondering if you could share your thoughts on what you think will happen in, say, the next 1 to 3 years, that area. And also, if you could talk a little bit more about Daniel, when you're saying about the word that you were investigating at the beginning of the show. And I can't remember exactly what you said, but it sounded really interesting. And I was hoping you'd talk more about that. And I'll just
All
take
right.
my questions off the air.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
What's going to happen in the next 1 to 3 years? An interesting question. I will answer that based on what I think will probably happen. The most immediate thing will be an economic crisis with the U.S. dollar and a huge global meltdown of the world financial system. It will be rapid, and I think within the next year we'll see this happen. I think we will see an escalation of the tensions between Israel and Iran to such a point that, and Syria as well, that a nuclear device will be exploded in one of the Arab countries. And whether it is by their own action or by the hand of Israel, I think that this will bring the world to the brink of a Middle East nuclear war, which could expand into the United States. I do think the United States will collapse from within. The economy will be one of the major driving forces, but then the measures put in place by the government to try to control the population when they start going rabid, you know, and civil disobedience is widespread, that what will happen there is the civil war will break out between various religious, various ethnic groups, citizens and illegals, this kind of stuff. There will be so many polarities to it, it won't be funny. And America will be involved in self-destruction at that point and be invaded by China, possibly Russia, and destroyed as a nation. I think there will be surviving pockets of people, because the Hopi Indians have told me this, the Navajo have told me this. So that will probably happen, and there will probably be a remaining culture, a small percentage of Americans somewhere in the Four Corners, you know, Utah, Colorado region of the United States. On a global basis, because of the economic chaos, because of the nuclear war threat, because of the environmental changes, climate change hitting food supplies, because of rampant diseases that will occur, I think that people will be crying out for someone to solve the planet, to solve all the problems and take it away. And that these people who do not know what is happening from the biblical point of view will accept the new world government set up by a man who will be just dragged into power like he didn't want it, but he always wanted it. And this man will have the support of a super being who poses as an alien god, according to the book of Daniel in the translations. They say he will be an imposter god, but he will play as though god, and he will give power and technology to the new world leader to solve these problems. And in return, the new world leader will give some of the 10 regions of the earth. The entire earth will be divided up into 10 regions. He will give some of the of those nations and their people to the alien, quote-unquote, little g god, which will be Satan, and his followers, to use as they wish. And so that will be the trade-off, some lands and people for technology, so the human antichrist of the age can rule the planet. This will be a short period of time, I'm sure, less than a decade, and probably just only 7 years, but there are two schools of thought on that. And I think this moment is upon us almost instantly. watch for the economic collapse of the dollar, and then hence the United, the whole planet's economy. At that point, I think we're going to see such chaos on the planet that, you know, and scramble for energy and resources that the Antichrist will rise up to power. And I have my ideas about who it is, but time will tell.
I have to tell you, Stan, that I hope you are dead wrong. I understand very clearly where you're coming from, but man, I don't want to see this happen.
Are you in denial?
No, I'm not in denial. I don't want to see it happen, though.
And, neither do I.
I really hope that this can be put off to some distant future date. But if it cannot, it cannot. Let's go to the telephone. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, I just wanted to say I was thinking that Stan was right on most things, but I was going to ask him a quick question.
Okay, go ahead.
Why were you holding back on the technology for anti-gravity and interstellar travel?
Well, first of all, I didn't work in that department. I had to pick up what I knew about what we were doing through discussions with other people who worked in those departments or either security in those departments. And they, through talking to them, I came to understand not only do we have the technology, I was told that by the guys that recruited me, but I was able to know that there are certain dangers with building these fields for craft, for instance.
I have two things to say real quick.
All right.
My first one was, I hope that God has something in plan for people to go back in time, because I think that we have to be a lot farther in technology than us to probably go back in time. Going in the future means nothing. My second question was, Nikola Tesla and Hutchinson have all proven anti-gravity technology, and even the Nazis in the 30s, we have the diagrams, everything. That's great in electromagnetic engineering theory, and it's been here for like 50 years. But when it comes to the ionization of all matter particles and things around us, do you think that ionization and other things would tell a story why things are lighting up and taking off and going from here to there and disappearing, besides just magnetism? Thank you.
If I understand your question, you're thinking that ionization is what makes things appear and disappear, I guess, meaning UFOs. Is that what you understood, Kevin?
That's what I understood.
Okay. The ionization around the field is caused by the atoms within that field moving very rapidly and creating friction, which at certain levels will emit light from just the air itself from being hot or ionized. It gets brighter as the energy is released at that corner once they go to back to normal time, so maybe that's explaining it. I'm kind of at a loss to understand the question completely, Kevin.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understood it completely. This brings up a question. When you raise the energy level, why isn't that cooking the people inside? I mean, if you put yourself in a microwave, you can raise the energy level and it'll cook you.
Yes, but you're raising the energy level in a chaotic manner. You're just throwing photons, wavelengths into matter and hitting it willy-nilly, and that will create friction. But if you increase the spin of the individual atoms uniformly, spin them up, so that they are not non-uniformly accelerated, then they will all be relative to each other. They won't be bouncing into each other like crazy. I mean, it'll be just like normal function, but okay.
Yeah, I understand. It's like if you take two sticks and rub them together, one against the other, really, really fast, you can create enough heat to create a fire. But if you just put these sticks end to end, you can toss them as fast as you want to, and they don't create friction and heat.
All right.
Is that right?
I think I understand what you're saying there. Are they atoms, like the sticks are like atoms?
Yeah. If you have them rubbing against each other rapidly, it creates the heat.
But if you throw them together where they don't intersect with each other, they'll have more energy, but they won't be creating friction between themselves.
Right.
Okay.
Now, if we're... Let me throw this at you, because you used the example several times tonight of spheres. And I have said on many occasions that I think all energy, unless you manipulate it, all energy comes out of its source, whatever its source is, and it comes out in all directions spherically, unless you manipulate it. You can have an explosion, and if you don't manipulate that explosion, then it's an omnidirectional explosion. Now, if you manipulate it, you can make it a directional explosion, which is what SWAT teams do. You've seen them do it where they put some stuff on a door, and then they explode it, and it carves a hole in the door where the SWAT team can go in. Well, what they've done...
It's a charge.
Yeah, it's a directional charge. They've manipulated the direction of the explosion. You can do that. But if you don't do it, then the energy released comes out in a sphere. It comes out omnidirectional, so that you have force going out in all directions at the same time. Okay, if that's true, then it would seem to me that if it's true that all energy is essentially spherical, it would seem to me that there's no such thing as a light wave as much as there is a light sphere.
Well, basically, yes. But the motion within that sphere of light, a light photon, if you wish, it is actually like a smoke ring traveling through space. It's a ripple without substance except for its own inertia. In the paper I'm doing now, you'll see when you see it, you'll get your jollies, because in the center of, say, like a planet, there is the planet, but there's this invisible wave pattern going out around it that is like a splash in a pond. But yet on the surface of the planet, it forms a sphere.
Okay, hold that thought. We'll get to it when we come back from this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Stan Deo this evening. Telephone lines are open, and we still have just a few minutes left in tonight's show. So if you've been wanting to call, trying to call, now's a good time. 623-444-5889 or toll free at 888-223-4599. Also, for those of you who are outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, we have the flash message option open, and we have a couple of flash messages, Stan, that we really have to get to because we just have a few minutes left. From Jesse in the United Kingdom, he's curious if you've heard of Mark Rodin's work on vortex-based mathematics.
No, I hadn't heard of that.
He says, Mark, Mr. Rodin has come up with a revolutionary system of mathematics involving whole numbers, toroidal constructs, and spirituality, which propose to explain life, the universe, and everything. He also discovered
like something out of The Hitchhiker's Guide?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not familiar with it. Rodin has also discovered the natural pathway that electricity wants to take without force, scientifically known as the longest mean free pathway of least resistance, and has discovered the source of non-decaying spin of electrons resulting in synchronized electricity without reluctance or friction. So I'm not familiar with that. I'll have
good.
To check that out.
I wonder if you could pass me that email or send it to me so I can get the spelling of the name correct and I'll check it out.
Sure. I'll forward it to you after the show.
Well, I can see if he's listening, I'll tell him thank you for that because I'm always interested in learning something else.
Also, we have Andrew from Australia who says, your thoughts on Antichristos and the Vatican?
He wants my thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think the Vatican is the Antichrist, if that's what you're speaking of, but I do think the Vatican at this point in time is not going to serve the Catholic laity or like the Catholic believers. It's not going to serve them well. It's going to probably give its support to the New World Leader. And so in that respect, I think that the Vatican will betray the faith and the faithful when the Antichrist comes to power.
Okay, and he also says here, great show, really shattered to hear about the passing of Dick Criswell. My condolences to the family. So, Andrew, thank you. And Jesse in the United Kingdom, thank you very much. The whole thing about the universe being fluid, you know, scientists are referring now, they used to talk about the vacuum of space, and now they don't. They talk about dark matter and dark energy. You know, there's a big search on to identify this dark matter and dark energy. Do you think they're going to find that?
I'm glad to see them looking for, you know, reasons why their models have failed. But whether they will find it or not really depends upon whether they can stand back like a child and look at the universe and look at what is obviously spinning waveforms in galaxies and stars and planets and like the rings of Saturn and Jupiter. The patterns are all there for us and simple to see if you just look at it simply and then say, okay, what we need is, if we want to use mathematical equations, we want to use what's called hydrodynamic or moving fluid equations. And once they do that, they can explain all these things. Gravity will be a two-directional force, a divergent-convergent wave type thing, and there will be spherical centers to gravitational fields, no matter how big they are. But when they will do that, I think, look, it's removing the noise from their minds, removing the blinders or you know that keep them focused in one direction and not letting them see other sides of the picture. It puts them into a niche and they can't get out of it. The system trains them, I think, incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
A case in point, I debated one professor of theoretical physics at a university there in Perth. And I was in his office, and we were talking about it, and he was saying it's impossible for a craft to hover in one spot, you know, say 15, 20 feet off the ground for 10 minutes. It would have to use too much power. It just couldn't do it. And I said, so in other words, a hot air balloon doesn't work. Oh, well, that's specific gravity. That doesn't count. So he's discounted the fact that you could generate a field, electromagnetically or otherwise, which would make a lighter version of yourself, your atoms, and keep you supported, because he's thinking still brute force, thrust reaction, thrust, you know, action reaction. Therefore, you have to be thrusting all the time. You can't develop a spinning sphere that is spinning in such a manner that the energy it's spinning comes back in at the poles and comes back out the equator, and it contains itself, so it doesn't use a lot of energy to sit there. It's at a level and it's going to stay there. So unless we can remove the blinders from the people that come through the system, they're not going to see this easily. But yet, when you say to them, look, here it is, they say, well, that can't be. That's specific gravity. That doesn't count. So I don't know when they're going to wake up. And I I'm hoping that what I'm doing in this paper will help some of the bright young minds out there now then to go beyond what I'm showing here and make the solid proofs that the physics community will accept and bridge from where we are now to where they should be.
What percentage of success would you assign to your project there? I mean, as predictive success. Would you say I'm about 80% sure that we're going to wake these people up, or I'm 20% sure? How would you predict
that? I don't think we're going to wake up. We're not going to wake up many people until the technology is manifest before them, until they see a half-mile wide or a mile wide craft supported over a city or all the major cities of the earth, and they'll say, "Wow, I guess we were wrong. It's magic." You know, then they'll have to see, because it's been done. They see it, then they'll have to understand where they went wrong. And percentage-wise, I would say that probably 96% of the physics, mathematical, engineering community of the world are in the dark. In 1957 at Chapel Hill in North Carolina, there was a conference on the role of gravitation in physics, and the leading lights of not only the United States but Great Britain, the world, attended this meeting to try to decide what kind of equations they should attempt to build to describe the universe and the things within it. And by far, the majority of over 40% of the votes they cast in that meeting were for making a fluid model of space to explain the vortexual appearances of the galaxies and that kind of stuff. And these were, at the time, the leading lights, and still many of them are, there's a few of them still alive, who proposed this, because they could see it with their eyes. And that's why I'm doing animations and graphics to show people what I'm talking about, because I want them to know and understand. I don't want them to be impressed with, you know, oh, what a novel idea Stanley's come up with. I want them to see how it works, and they can build on that. And hopefully that will help some.
Well, Stan, we're out of time. As always, it's always fascinating when you're with me on the show. And
thank you.
It's been fascinating again tonight. I can think of about 100 other questions now that I've got, but we just don't have time. But I want to thank you for being with me tonight.
Thank you for inviting me, Kevin. Appreciate it.
All right. If you will, just stay on the phone with me here for just a moment. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's going to be a wrap for this evening. Remember to keep the family of Dick Criswell in your prayers and thoughts. Of course, it's a very, very tough time for them, and we'll miss it. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time. So long, everybody.